Chapter 8. Play. Meet Madan Kataria, a physician in Mumbai, India. Dr. Kataria likes to laugh. A lot. In fact, he believes that laughter can function like a benevolent virus, that it can infect individuals, communities, even nations. So a few years ago, he scaled back his medical practice and refashioned himself as the Typhoid Mary of laughter. His mission? To trigger an international laughter epidemic that he says can improve our health, increase our profits, and maybe even bring world peace. His means of transmission? Laughter clubs, small groups of people who come together early each morning at parks, village greens, and shopping centers to spend a half hour laughing. Kataria's plan to change the world by making it laugh can seem, well, laughable. But if you visit a laughter club, as I did one damp morning in Mumbai, you can see there's a method to his mirth. Today, about 2,500 laughter clubs convene regularly around the world. Many of them are in India, including nearly 100 clubs in Mumbai, and even more in the high-tech haven of Bangalore. But others have sprung up in the West, in the United Kingdom, Germany, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Canada, and several hundred clubs in the United States. The fastest growing venue for these clubs is the workplace. I'll come back to this self-anointed guru of giggles later in this chapter, but his popularity around the world, and especially the gradual acceptance of laughter clubs in offices and boardrooms, reveals another important dimension of the conceptual age, a move away from sober seriousness as a measure of ability, and the elevation of the next essential high-concept, high-touch aptitude, play. The whole purpose of the laughter club is to be more playful, Kataria told me. When you are playful, you are activating the right side of your brain. The logical brain is a limited brain. The right side is unlimited. You can be anything you want. Contrast Kataria's movement and the workplace laughter clubs it has spawned with the Ford Motor Company of the 1930s and 1940s. At Ford's River Rouge plant, laughter was a disciplinary offense, and humming, whistling, and smiling were evidence of insubordination. As British management scholar David Collinson recounts, in 1940, John Galla was sacked because he was caught in the act of smiling, after having committed an earlier breach of laughing with the other fellows and slowing down the line maybe half a minute. This tight managerial discipline reflected the overall philosophy of Henry Ford, who stated that when we are at work, we ought to be at work. When we are at play, we ought to be at play. There is no use trying to mix the two. Work and play, Ford feared, was a toxic combination. If they weren't quarantined, each would poison the other. But in the conceptual age, as abundance releases organizations from the post-depression grimness that gripped the River Rouge plant, commingling work and play has become both more common and more necessary. At times, it is even an explicit corporate strategy. Take the airline business. Southwest Airlines is one of today's most successful carriers, earning a regular profit while many of its competitors wobble on the edge of insolvency. The company's mission statement offers clues to its stellar performance. It says, "People rarely succeed in anything unless they are having fun doing it." A 180-degree turn from Ford's mandated joylessness. And it's not just one zany American corporation that is supplementing the work ethic with a play ethic. According to the Wall Street Journal, more than 50 European companies, including less-than-zany firms such as Nokia, Daimler Chrysler, and Alcatel, have brought in consultants in serious play, a technique that uses Lego building blocks to train corporate executives. British Airways has even hired its own corporate jester to imbue the airline with a greater sense of fun. Like its five sibling senses, play is emerging from the shadows of frivolousness and assuming its place in the spotlight. Homo ludens, man the player, is proving to be as effective as Homo sapiens, man the knower, in getting the job done. Play is becoming an important part of work, business, and personal well-being. its importance manifesting itself in three ways: games, humor, and joyfulness. Games, particularly computer and video games, have become a large and influential industry that is teaching whole-minded lessons to its customers and recruiting a new breed of whole-minded worker. Humor is showing itself to be an accurate marker for managerial effectiveness, emotional intelligence, and the thinking style characteristic of the brain's right hemisphere. And joyfulness, as exemplified by unconditional laughter, is demonstrating its power to make us more productive and fulfilled. In the conceptual age, as we'll see, fun and games are not just fun and games, and laughter is no laughing matter. Games. Not too long ago, I discovered what turned out to be a popular video game called America's Army. When you play this game, you navigate a treacherous environment, trying to knock off bad guys while avoiding getting whacked yourself. You earn points for nailing opposing soldiers and for helping your side elude harm, a format and structure similar to most games in this genre. So here's a question. Which company makes the game? Nintendo? Sega? Electronic Arts? Nope. The organization that created, manufactured, and distributed America's Army is America's Army, the United States military. A few years ago, Colonel Casey Wardinsky, a West Point professor who specializes in military manpower, was working on ways to boost recruiting for the armed forces, which had fallen to dismal levels. Because the draft had ended in the 1970s and the size of the military had shrunk after the end of the Cold War, potential recruits knew much less than previous generations about what it was like to serve in the armed forces. While chewing on this problem, Wardinsky noticed that the cadets he was teaching at West Point were obsessed with video games. And in a flash of right-brain inspiration, he glimpsed a possible solution. What if, Wardinsky wondered, the military tried reaching young people where they live, on Sony PlayStations, Microsoft Xboxes, and personal computers? Since gauzy television ads and person-to-person persuasion couldn't give recruits a feel for the reality of military service, perhaps the Army could, as Wardinsky put it, substitute virtual experiences for vicarious insights by creating a video game. He presented his plan to the Pentagon brass, which, concerned about a shortfall in personnel, was willing to try anything. They gave Wardinsky a healthy budget, and he began formulating a game that he thought would convey the substance of Army life while also being engaging and challenging to play. Over the next year, he and a team from the Naval Postgraduate School, with the help of several programmers and artists, built America's Army and released it for free on the GoArmy.com website on July 4, 2002. That first weekend, demand was so great that it crashed the Army servers. Today, the game, which is also distributed on disc at recruiting offices and in gaming magazines, has more than 2 million registered users. On a typical weekend, nearly a 500,000 people sit in front of computer screens maneuvering through simulated military missions. America's Army says it's different from many other martial games because of its emphasis on teamwork, values, and responsibility as a means of achieving the goals. Players go through basic training, advance to multiplayer games where they work in small units, and if they're successful, move on to become Green Berets. Most of the missions are team endeavors: rescuing a prisoner of war, protecting a pipeline, thwarting a weapons sale to terrorists. Players earn points not only for killing enemies, but also for protecting other soldiers and for completing a mission with everyone in the unit still alive. If you try something stupid, for instance gunning down civilians or ignoring orders, you can end up in a virtual Leavenworth prison or find yourself banished from the game altogether. And like any producer with a hit on its hands, the Army has produced a sequel, a new edition of the game called America's Army Special Forces. This ought to throw a bucket of cold water on the overheated belief that play is an aptitude only for the hacky sack set. The reality is more surprising. Just as General Motors is in the art business, the U.S. military is in the game business. Indeed, had the military sold the game at a price comparable to other video games, the Army would have earned about $600 million in the first year. The military's embrace of video games is just one example of the influence of these games. From their humble beginnings 30 years ago, when Pong, one of the very first, made its appearance in arcades, video games, that is, games played on computers, on the web, and on dedicated platforms such as PlayStation and Xbox, have become a booming business and a prominent part of everyday life. For example, half of all Americans over age 6 play computer and video games. Each year, Americans purchase more than 220 million games, nearly two games for every U.S. household. And despite the common belief that gaming is a pastime that requires a Y chromosome, today more than 40% of game players are women. In the United States, the video game business is larger than the motion picture industry. Americans spend more on video games than they do on movie tickets. On average, Americans devote 75 hours a year to playing video games, double the time they spent in 1977, and more time than they spend watching DVDs and videos. One game company, Electronic Arts, is now part of the S&P 500 index. In 2004, Electronic Arts earned nearly $3 billion, more than the combined revenue of the year's top 10 grossing movies. Nintendo's Mario series of video games has earned more than $7 billion over its lifetime, double the money earned by all the Star Wars movies. Still, unless they live in a home with thumb-twitching teenagers, many adults haven't fully comprehended the significance of these games. For a generation of people, games have become a tool for solving problems, as well as a vehicle for self-expression and self-exploration. Video games are as woven into this generation's lives as television was into that of their predecessors. For example, according to several surveys, the percentage of American college students who say they've played video games is 100. On campuses today, you'd sooner find a short-tailed tree frog taking calculus than an undergrad who's never fired up Myst, Grand Theft Auto, or SimCity. As two Carnegie Mellon University professors write, "We routinely poll our students on their experience with the media, and typically we cannot find a single movie that all 50 students in the course have seen. Only about a third have usually seen Casablanca, for instance. However, we typically find at least one video game that every student has played, like Super Mario Brothers." Some people, many of them members of my own 40-something geezer set, tend to despair over such information, fearing that each minute spent wielding a joystick represents a step backward for individual intelligence and social progress. But that attitude misunderstands the power of these games. In fact, James Paul Gee, a professor at the University of Wisconsin and author of What Video Games Have to Teach Us About Learning and Literacy, argues that games can be the ultimate learning machine. Video games operate with, that is, they build into their designs and encourage, good principles of learning, principles that are better than those in many of our skill and drill, back to basics, test them till they drop schools. That's why so many people buy video games and then spend 50 to 100 hours mastering them, roughly the length of a college semester. As G writes, "The fact is, when kids play video games, they can experience a much more powerful form of learning than when they're in the classroom. Learning isn't about memorizing isolated facts. It's about connecting and manipulating them." Indeed, a growing stack of research is showing that playing video games can sharpen many of the skills that are vital in the conceptual age. For instance, an important 2003 study in the journal Nature found an array of benefits to playing video games. On tests of visual perception, game players scored 30% higher than non-players. Playing video games enhanced individuals' ability to detect changes in the environment and their capacity to process information simultaneously. Even doctors can benefit from a little time at the GameCube. One study found that physicians who spent at least 3 hours a week playing video games made about 37% fewer mistakes in laparoscopic surgery and performed the task 27% faster than their counterparts who did not play. Another study even found that playing video games at work can boost productivity and enhance job satisfaction. There's also evidence that playing video games enhances the right brain ability to solve problems that require pattern recognition. Many aspects of video gaming resemble the aptitude of symphony, spotting trends, drawing connections, and discerning the big picture. What we need people to learn is how to think deeply about complex systems, modern workplaces, the environment, international relations, social interactions, cultures, etc., where everything interacts in complicated ways with everything else, and bad decisions can make for disasters, says G. Computer and video games can teach that. In addition, the fastest growing category of games isn't shooter games like America's Army, but role-playing games, which require players to assume the identity of a character and to navigate a virtual world through the eyes of that figure. Experiences with those simulation games can deepen the aptitude of empathy and offer rehearsals for the social interactions of our lives. What's more, games have begun to reach the medical field. For example, children with diabetes can now use GlucoBoy, which hooks up to a Nintendo Game Boy to monitor their glucose levels. And at California's Virtual Reality Medical Center, therapists are treating phobias and other anxiety disorders with video games that simulate driving, flying, heights, tight spaces, and other fear-inducing situations. To be sure, games aren't perfect. Some evidence points to a correlation between game playing and aggressive behavior, though it's unclear whether a causal link exists. And certain games are utter time wasters. But video games are much more valuable than hand-wringing parents or family values moralists would want you to believe. And the aptitudes players are mastering are especially well-suited to an age that relies on the right side of the brain. Along with being an avocation of millions, gaming is becoming a vocation for hundreds of thousands, and an especially home-minded vocation at that. The ideal hire, says one game industry recruiter, is someone who can bridge that left-brain-right brain divide. Companies resist segregating the disciplines of art, programming, math, and cognitive psychology, and instead look for those who can piece together patches of many disciplines and weave them together into a larger tapestry. And both the maturation of games and the offshoring of routine programming work to Asia are changing the emphasis of the gaming profession. As one gaming columnist writes, changes in the way games are built indicate less of a future demand for coders, but more of a demand for artists, producers, storytellers, and designers. We've moved away from relying simply on code, said one gaming developer. It's become much more of an artistic medium. That's one reason that many arts schools now offer degrees in game art and design. DigiPen Institute of Technology near Seattle, which awards a 4-year degree in video gaming, is, as USA Today puts it, fast becoming the Harvard among joystick-clenching students fresh out of high school. The school's nickname? Donkey Kong U. The University of Southern California's renowned School of Cinema Television now offers a Master's of Fine Arts degree in Game Studies. When USC started a film school 75 years ago, there were skeptics, said Chris Swain, who teaches game design at USC. We believe games are the literature of the 21st century. When you look at games today, it may be difficult to see that, but the pieces are in place for this to happen. The purest expression of the centrality of gaming in the emerging economy might exist at Carnegie Mellon University's Entertainment Technology Center, a collaboration between its College of Fine Arts and School of Computer Science. Carnegie Mellon offers an entirely new degree, a Master's in Entertainment Technology, which bills itself as a graduate program for the left and right brain. Students study everything from programming to business to improvisational theater and earn neither an arts degree nor a science degree, but an interdisciplinary degree that the school says is the academic pinnacle of studies in this field, thus having greater significance than the MA or MS and the equivalent academic weight of an MFA and or MBA degree. If the MFA is the new MBA, one day soon the MET might be the new MFA. It's a degree that requires and enables a whole new mind. Humor. With the subject of games fresh in our heads, let's play a game. I call it Pick the Punchline. Here's how it works. I'll give you the first part of a joke, the setup, then you select the correct punchline from four choices. Ready? It's a Saturday in June, and Mr. Jones sees his next-door neighbor, Mr. Smith, outside and walks toward him. Hey, Smith, Jones asks, are you using your lawnmower this afternoon? Smith replies warily, yes, I am. Now pick the punchline. What does Jones say next? A. Oh, well, can I borrow it when you're done? B. Great, then you won't be using your golf clubs. Can I borrow them? C. Oops, as he steps on a rake that nearly hits him in the face. D. The birds are always eating my grass seed. The correct punchline, of course, is B. Answer A is logical, but not surprising or funny. Answer C is surprising, and its slapstick quality might elicit laughs, but it doesn't follow coherently from the setup. Answer D is a complete non sequitur. I didn't hear this joke at a nightclub or on an HBO comedy special. I plucked it from a 1999 neuroscience study published in the journal Brain, which might explain why the joke isn't exactly a side splitter. To test the role the two hemispheres of the brain play in processing humor, two neuroscientists, Prabhatha Shami and Donald Stuss, conducted an experiment in which they administered this pick the punchline test to a series of subjects. The control group, people with intact brains, chose B, the punchline you probably selected. But the experimental group, which consisted of people with damage to their right hemisphere, in particular that hemisphere's frontal lobe, rarely chose that answer. Instead, they usually selected one of the other answers, with a slight preference for answer C, in which Mr. Jones gets clonked in the nose by a rake. From their research, the neuroscientists concluded that the right hemisphere plays an essential role in understanding and appreciating humor. When that hemisphere is impaired, the brain's ability to process even semi-sophisticated comedy suffers. The reason has to do with both the nature of humor and the particular specialties of the right hemisphere. Humor often involves incongruity. A story is moving along when suddenly something surprising and incongruous occurs. The left hemisphere doesn't like surprise or incongruity. Golf clubs, it yelps. What does that have to do with mowing the lawn? This doesn't make any sense. So, as with metaphors and nonverbal expression, it calls over for help from its companion hemisphere, which in this case resolves the incongruity by making sense of the comment in a new way. You see, explains the right side, Jones is tricking Smith. Ha, ha, ha. But if the joke-loving, incongruity-resolving right hemisphere becomes hobbled, the brain has much greater difficulty understanding humor. Instead of surprise being followed by coherence, the chain reaction of an effective joke, the attempted yuck just lingers, an incongruous, confusing set of events. The importance of this joke-getting specialization goes beyond the ease with which someone can choose the proper punchline. Shami and Stuss maintain that humor represents one of the highest forms of human intelligence. This entire story has profound implications, they write. The right frontal lobe has been, and in some cases still is, considered the most silent of brain areas. In contrast, it may represent one of the most important human brain regions, and is critical to the highest and most evolved human cognitive functions. Humor embodies many of the right hemisphere's most powerful attributes, the ability to place situations in context, to glimpse the big picture, and to combine differing perspectives into new alignments. And that makes this aspect of play increasingly valuable in the world of work. As Fabio Sala writes in the Harvard Business Review, more than four decades of study by various researchers confirm some common sense wisdom. Humor, used skillfully, greases the management wheels. It reduces hostility, deflects criticism, relieves tension, improves morale, and helps communicate difficult messages. According to the research, the most effective executives deployed humor twice as often as middle-of-the-pack managers. A natural facility with humor, Salas says, is intertwined with and appears to be a marker for a much broader managerial trait, high emotional intelligence. Humor can be a volatile substance in organizations, of course. Attempts to manufacture humor can actually suppress it, while the suppression of jocularity may also lead to its resurgence, writes David Collinson, who related the tale of the Dower Ford plant and who studies humor in organizations. And it comes in different strengths with varying side effects. Negative humor, for instance, can be especially destructive. It can rip through an organization, carving divisions that are difficult to bridge. Far from always being a source of social cohesion, humor can reflect and reinforce, articulate and highlight workplace divisions, tensions, conflicts, power asymmetries, and inequalities, Collinson writes. But used more sensibly, humor can be a clarifying organizational elixir. As Collinson puts it, jokes that people tell at the workplace can reveal as much or perhaps more about the organization, its management, its culture, and its conflicts than answers to carefully administered surveys. Thomas A. Stewart, editor-in-chief of the Harvard Business Review, has suggested mining corporate skits for clues about an organization's soul. After he discovered that many of Enron's shady dealings were lampooned at the company's talent show well before auditors had any inkling of wrongdoing at the now notorious energy company. And humor can be a cohesive force in organizations, as anyone who's ever traded jokes at the water cooler or laughed over lunch with colleagues understands. Instead of disciplining the joke crackers, as Ford did in the last century, organizations should be seeking them out and treating a sense of humor as an asset. It's time to rescue humor from its status as mere entertainment and recognize it for what it is, a sophisticated and uniquely human form of intelligence that can't be replicated by computers and that is becoming increasingly valuable in a high-concept, high-touch world. Joyfulness. Everything in India always starts a little late, except the Laughter Club, which begins exactly on time. At 6:30 a.m., Kiri Agarwal blows her whistle, and 43 people, including Dr. Kataria, his wife Madhuri, and I, assemble in a shaggy semicircle. Agarwal pauses, and then all 44 of us begin walking about, clapping our hands in unison while shouting, "Ho, ho, ha, 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 ho, ho, ha, ha, ha," over and over again. We're in the Prabhadan Sports Complex, a few miles from Kataria's home in a residential section of northwest Bombay, where what passes for a sports complex is a crumbly concrete wall surrounding a muddy soccer field and a cracked running track. For the next 40 minutes, I do things, in public, with strangers, I've never done before. With the other members of the Laughing Club, I move through a series of exercises that resemble yoga and calisthenics, with a little method acting thrown in for good measure. One of our first exercises is the Namaste laugh. We place our palms together, bring them prayerfully before our faces in the traditional Hindu greeting, gaze at another participant, and then laugh. I find it difficult, so I begin simply bellowing the syllables, ha, 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 ha. Then something strange happens. My forced guffaws begin to feel more natural, and the laughter of others seems to call my own out of hiding. A bit later comes an exercise called just laughter. I follow the lead of Kataria, who's come decked out in jeans, a diamond earring stud, and a red t-shirt that reads, "Think globally, laugh locally." He raises his palms upward, walks in circles, and repeats aloud, "I don't know why I'm laughing." I do the same. Kataria's laugh seems to transport him to another realm. Then, after each laugh, we do another one-minute round of clapping to the 1-2, 1-2-3 refrain of ho-ho, ha-ha-ha. The experience is simultaneously weird and invigorating. It's weird to see 43 people, most of them older women dressed in saris, doing the lion laughter, in which they stick out their tongues, hold up their hands as if they're claws, and screech like people possessed. But it's invigorating to be outside and to laugh for no reason, because, despite my skepticism, it does feel good. Later, when we return to his office, Kataria tells me how laughter came to define his life. He was born, the youngest of 8 children, in a small village in the state of Punjab. His parents weren't educated, he says, but his mother wanted him to become a doctor. Kataria went to medical school and in the 1980s began practicing internal medicine from a mobile unit that he drove around Bombay. In the early 1990s, he began editing a health magazine, My Doctor, along with treating patients. After noticing that patients got better faster when they laughed, he wrote an article in 1995 entitled, Laughter, the Best Medicine. If laughing is so good, Kataria says he thought to himself, why not start a laughter club? The idea came to my mind as a flash at 4 in the morning on the 13th of March, 1995. And within 3 hours, I went to a public park and started asking people if they wanted to laugh with me in a laughing club. He had only 4 takers, but he explained the benefits of laughing. The 5 of them told a bunch of jokes, and afterward, everybody felt good. They continued the following day, but by day 10, they encountered an obstacle. They'd run out of jokes. Kataria was stuck. But then he says he realized that they might not need a joke to laugh. He talked to his wife, a yoga teacher, about creating a series of laughter exercises and concluded, why not combine yoga breathing with laughter to make laughter yoga? And thus a movement was born. If I were not a doctor, people would have laughed at me, he says. That line always cracks him up. He closes his eyes, throws his head back, and laughs. For Kataria, humor is not a prerequisite for laughter. The goal of his clubs is thought-free laughter. If you're laughing, you cannot think. This is the objective we achieve in meditation. The meditative mind is the route to joyfulness. Joyfulness differs from happiness, Kataria says. Happiness is conditional. Joyfulness is unconditional. When you depend on something else to make you laugh, the laughter doesn't belong to you. That's a conditional laugh. But in laughter clubs, the source of laughter is not outside the body, it is within us. Kataria points out that children don't really grasp humor early in life, yet they laugh from the time they are infants. In fact, folklore has it that children laugh hundreds of times a day, and adults barely a dozen. Yogic laughter in a group, he says, can help people go from the conditional happiness of adults to the unconditional joyfulness of children. I want people to reclaim their childlike playfulness, he tells me. Now, usually the mere hint that I need to pick up my inner child from the daycare of my subconscious makes me roll my eyes and hide my wallet. But the science mostly backs up Kataria's claims about laughter's virtues. Laughter won't cure tuberculosis, but this odd human activity, emitting pulsating paroxysms of air and sound through our pie hole, is undeniably good for us. For example, studies by Dr. Lee Burke of the Center for Neuroimmunology at the Loma Linda School of Medicine show that laughter can decrease stress hormones and boost the immune system. Robert Provine, a neuroscientist and author of the book Laughter, A Scientific Investigation, notes, the scientific record offers modest but growing support for the analgesic properties of humor and laughter. What's more, laughter has aerobic benefits. It activates the cardiovascular system, increases the heart rate, and pumps more blood into internal organs. Provine reports that laughter researcher William Fry found that it took 10 minutes of rowing on his home exercise machine to reach the heart rate produced by 1 minute of hearty laughter. Perhaps most important, laughter is a social activity, and the evidence is vast that people who have regular, satisfying connections to other people are healthier and happier. Laughter, says Provine, has more to do with relationships than jokes. We rarely laugh alone. Yet we often can't help but laugh when others begin to chuckle. Laughter is a form of nonverbal communication that conveys empathy and that is even more contagious than the yawning we did in Chapter 7. Laughter clubs, which like laughter itself are always free, combine elements of four good things: yoga, meditation, aerobics, and social contact, into a fifth good thing. And that's why Kataria believes that the next frontier of laughter clubs is the place where stress runs most rampant, the workplace. Laughter can play a major role in reducing stress in the workplace, he says. Kataria says that businesses believe that serious people are more responsible. That's not true. That's yesterday's news. Laughing people are more creative people. They are more productive people. People who laugh together can work together. Companies such as Glaxo and Volvo have gotten the message and organized laughing clubs. And Steve Wilson, a Kataria disciple and self-described joyologist in Ohio, is taking the message to corporate America. Says Kataria, there should be a laughing room in every company. If you can have a smoking room in a company, why not have a laughing room? I doubt that IBM will set up a laughing room anytime soon, though there were probably those who doubted whether Fortune 500 execs would ever pay money to play with Legos. But it seems clear that in an age of abundance, laughter provides something the left brain cannot. More broadly, today a play ethic can strengthen and ennoble the work ethic. Games are teaching a variety of whole-minded lessons to a new generation of workers and have given rise to an industry that demands several of the key skills of the conceptual age. Humor represents many aspects of the sophisticated thinking required in automated and outsourced times, and just plain laughter can lead to joyfulness, which in turn can lead to greater creativity, productivity, and collaboration. The limited brain is a technology, Kataria tells me after we finish breakfast and the clock is edging toward noon. You do this, you get this. You do that, you get that. It's mathematics. Laughter I see as a divine mathematics. It doesn't make 2 plus 2 equal 4. 2 plus 2 can equal 64. Then he laughs. Play portfolio. Find a laughter club. One easy way to add some levity to your life is to visit a laughter club. These groups are growing at such a rapid clip that there's probably one near you. Dr. Madan Kataria, the guru of giggles, has also produced a book, video, and DVD, Laugh for No Reason, that explain the basics of laughter yoga, as well as the theory and science supporting it. The reading and viewing materials will set you back about $30, but the clubs themselves are free. As Kataria puts it, no forms, no fee, no fuss. Also, in the springtime, be sure to watch for World Laughter Day, which is held each year on the first Sunday of May. Repeat after me, ho, ho, ha, ha, ha. For more information or a list of laughter clubs, go to www.laughteryoga.org. Play the cartoon captions game. In Chapter 2, we learned about the Rainbow Project, an alternative SAT devised by Robert Sternberg, now at Tufts University, that measures more whole-minded abilities. One of the exercises on that anti-SAT asks test takers to supply captions to New Yorker magazine cartoons that have had their captions removed. Try a version of this exercise yourself, preferably with a few other people. Select 5 or 6 cartoons from the New Yorker. Cut them out of the magazine, but cover up the caption. Then show the captionless cartoon to your pals and ask them to devise a caption of their own. Lather, rinse, repeat. You'll be surprised by how challenging and fun this can be. It's also good training for the caption contest that appears on the back page of every New Yorker issue. For background on this exercise and on the broader subject of witty cartoons, consult New Yorker cartoon editor Robert Mankoff's book, The Naked Cartoonist. And if you're really into this, check out the Mankoff-edited The Complete Cartoons of the New Yorker, which includes a companion CD with all 68,647 cartoons ever published in the magazine. Mankoff says captions require rhythm, brevity, and surprise, and the humor contained in them depends on a right-brain sensibility. Most cartoons or funny ideas have this weird combining aspect, he writes. It is a conceptual blending and overlapping of categories that the conscious mind resists, but that is absolutely necessary to create new ideas. A provocative way to think about it is that it is as if a couple of ideas got together and had sex. Another exercise. Step on the humor scale. James Thorson, a professor at the University of Nebraska, Omaha, has devised a multidimensional sense of humor scale, which has been used by both researchers and clinicians to measure individuals' level of mirth. The test asks things like whether you use humor to cope and whether your friends consider you a wit. Thorson's research has found that those who score high on a multidimensional sense of humor scale have lower levels of depression and higher levels of purpose than those who score low in humor. Take the test yourself and see where you stand. Here's the URL, www.tinyurl.com/6T7FF. Get your game on. You must understand video games. Seriously, you must. So if you don't know a joystick from a jelly roll, spend some time getting up to speed on games played on computers, online, and on special devices such as Game Boys and PlayStations. Ask your kid, ask your neighbor's kid, or go into an electronics store such as Best Buy, where the games are usually on display, and ask for a demo. You won't regret it. And you may even become hooked. At the very least, you'll be able to understand the powerful new grammar, narrative patterns, and thinking style these games are teaching. For added nuance about this world, page through any of the many gaming magazines now available. Look for them near the games in that electronics store. And investigate the following websites, which offer smart primers and some snippets of cool games. GameSpot, a comprehensive gaming site, and one of the best around. www.gamespot.com. Game Talk, an online community for gamers. www.gametalk.com. Game Zone, another comprehensive gaming site with news and reviews for games on every platform. www.gamezone.com. News Gaming. Operating at the boundary of gaming and political commentary, this site offers games based on current events. Go to www.newsgaming.com. There. This site bills itself as an online getaway. You become a character and then hang out with other players on a nifty island-like setting. This might not ultimately be your cup of chai, but the free trial is worth exploring to get a sense of what role-playing games are like. There's more info at www.there.com. Wireless Gaming Review. This site is a great source of information about wireless gaming, games you can play on your cell phone and on other wireless devices. Lots of free downloads, too. Go to www.wgamer.com. Women Gamers. The Internet's largest portal for women gamers, this site features the usual reviews and product announcements, as well as great information about industry trends. Go to www.womengamers.com. And finally, Yahoo Games. A good introduction to online games, this site allows you to play everything from backgammon to Canasta to dozens of more games with people around the world. go to games.yahoo.com. Another suggestion. Go back to school. The best way to get in touch with your inner child is to take it outside for some play. So, go back to school, or at least, back to the playground. Visit a schoolyard, take a seat on a bench, and watch how the real kids play. See if some of their sense of wonder and curiosity penetrates your adult immune system. To mix business with pleasure, schedule your next staff retreat in an elementary school. Talking about strategic priorities takes on new meaning when you're in a classroom whose bulletin boards admonish everyone to play fair, don't hit, and be nice. And if this retro approach is really working for you, head to a children's museum for a day of discovery. You'll benefit not only from tackling the hands-on museum exhibits, but also by soaking in the learning and laughing of the little people around you. These places likewise offer a nice alternative for meetings and retreats. Check out the Association of Children's Museums website for links to children's museums around the world. Go to www.childrensmuseums.org. A final suggestion. Dissect a joke. A nun, a rabbi, and a priest walk into a bar. The bartender looks up at them and says, "What is this, a joke?" Actually, it is. And if you ask me, it's a pretty funny joke, too. But why? Giving that question some thought can strengthen your play muscles. Next time you hear a joke, laugh, if it's funny. Then try to figure out what made it humorous. Was it the ambiguity of a phrase? Was it the sound of a particular word? Was it another instance of the right hemisphere's ability to resolve incongruity? I don't want you to take a purely clinical approach to humor. Your popularity among your peers matters to me. But if you occasionally step back and reverse engineer a joke or funny line, you'll gain a deeper comprehension of which kinds of humor work, and more important, which don't.